At the Table with Tony is brought to you by Trafe Hustlin'. That's www.traifhustlin.com. Your home for all things barbecue. Welcome to At the Table with Tony. My name is Anthony Sciglia, better known as Tony Mangia. And tonight we're doing an Italian-American Authors Roundtable. So I have the pleasure of welcoming onto the show Michelle Reale. She is the editor of Ovunque Siamo. We're also joined by Stephanie Longo. She is an author. Actually, I have some of her books here. I have the Italians of Northeastern Pennsylvania, the Italians of Lackawanna County. And we're also joined by Raymond Guarini. He is the founder of the Italian Enclaves Historical Society. And he also wrote this book here, New York City. There it is. New York City Italian Neighborhoods, along with our friend John Napoli. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for taking some time out to come on the show tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.
How is everybody doing in this crazy time that we are living in?
Moving through it.
Yeah, exactly.
We're moving through it.
Well, thank God we have things like this to keep us preoccupied. Last night, I was riveted on my screen for 2 hours listening to you interview Paulie G, which is a tough act to follow.
I love Paulie G. Him and his wife Mary, Mrs. I call her name is Marianne, but I call her Mrs. G. They are two beautiful people. They are Brooklyn people through and through. And we had a great time. I tell you, I couldn't even believe 2 hours. 2 hours went by like a click of my fingers. It was amazing. Blink it was over.
We talked to you.
I don't think I'm that entertaining, but I enjoy doing this. So, Michelle, tell us a little bit about Ovunque Siamo. What exactly are you doing? So it's a website, right? So you do, is it a online kind of a?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's an online literature, and it's basically, I started it because I'm interested in Italian American writing. I'm interested in curating that writing, and I am interested in people thinking towards writing their culture. So when I started this online journal, I wanted the journal to be generative. So in other words, I wanted people who were Italian American and who were writers who didn't normally think of themselves as Italian-American writers to start thinking of themselves that way, so as to generate work that explicates the culture. I don't think there's enough of that, and I think that I think we need more of it. And I think the further we get out from immigration, I think that this generation doesn't really have the sense of being Italian American like we did, because we were so close to, you know, to immigration. So I'm a college professor, and you know, a lot of my students that have Italian American last names have no real link to their culture. You know, taking on some interns from my university that have worked with the magazine who are Italian American now have this newfound awakening of their culture and where they're from and you know, where their families originally came from. So it's been a great experience, really.
That is great. You know, so let me ask you, where is your family from in Italy?
So my father's father is from a little town called Blufi in Sicily. And then his mother is from Maida in Calabria. And my mother's family are from the Campobasso region in Italy.
What part of Campobasso? Do you know the town?
Vinafro.
Okay.
And Riccia.
Riccia, okay.
Yeah.
So when they came over from Italy, where did your family first settle?
So I live in Pennsylvania, a small town in Pennsylvania, and I'd say 90% of the Italians that live in my town, and believe me, there are plenty, come from Maida in Calabria.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so most of us are Maidese, and we identify that way. But I very much identify with the Sicilian side of my family. I spend a lot of time in Sicily. I've done a lot of work there. A lot of my writing has centered on Sicily. So I like to say I'm Sicilian American. But in my town, in the parish, in the school that I went to, the street I grew up on, everyone was basically from Calabria, from Maida. So,
oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So what crazy question. So what was the patron saint of Maida?
It's Saint Francesco de Paula.
Oh,
yeah.
A great Calabrese saint. Yeah, right. Now, wait a second. Is this the same town that does the feast for him? The weekend after Easter?
Yes, exactly.
I was supposed to actually attend that this year, but of course, with all the craziness that went on, it was canceled.
Right. So, it's a huge thing in my town. There's a parade and there's a festival. And there are men, you know, cooking vats of pasta chicharri, and it's been going on for such a long time. And it coincides when they do it in Maida also. So Maida and Ambler, the town that I live in, are like twin. They're twin cities, twin towns.
Okay.
And there's a lot of good feeling back and forth.
So you have a book that is a collection of poetry, correct?
That's one of them. Yeah.
Okay. This is my, the one I have on the screen right now, Season of Subtraction.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. This book is, was a book of poems about my father's family, actually. Mm-hmm. And, my grandfather, just a few months before he married my grandmother, had a liaison with a woman, that resulted in a child. That was only rumored about in the family. And when I found out when I was about 17 years old, I couldn't abide the fact that my father had a sister that was born 9 months before he was, and that no one knew anything about her. And I made it my mission for a long, long time to try to find her.
Wow.
Yeah, in the days before the internet, and things like that, that was very hard. I was always asking my father questions. My father's a very quiet man. And my father's siblings, who I love dearly and I'm very close to all of them, couldn't really tell me much more than that they believed she existed. To make a long story short, I took a DNA test, and that same week that I took one, my father's sister, her son took one, and we matched up. And in 1 week, after all of those years of looking, my father's sister is 86, and she lives in Florida, and she is an absolutely wonderful woman. And I wrote this book of prose poems based on my imagining of what her life must have been before we met her, and some of the things that I and my family went through.
Wow.
Intervening years while I was looking for her. I think it's very Italian American. It's very, the essence of the entire book is boiled down to, or the essence of it is how secrets are so toxic, because I think that her absence in the family created, a void that was really never spoken about.
Hmm.
And one of my uncles actually told me at a family affair 2 or 3 years ago that he actually, you know, he knew that I thought she existed, but he said he didn't believe she really existed.
Oh, wow.
So I have used my father's family, actually, and his siblings as my muses. They are endlessly fascinating to me, and I think I'll probably be writing about this family for forever. They're a very complex, incredibly wonderful, wonderful family, and there's a lot lying just below the surface. So,
well, I think that's true for a lot of Italian American families, or a lot of Italian families. We are complex to a certain extent. You know, sometimes we have secrets. Sometimes we don't always Sometimes we do wear our heart on the sleeve. Sometimes we prefer to keep everything close to the vest. But I think that's one of the amazing things of the Italian culture. And really, just to talk a little bit, I want to talk to Ray now a little bit about his book and about let me see what Ray, you have to unmute. Yeah, there you go. You have to unmute yourself. Right? There you go. Perfect. Ray wrote. So your website or the society concentrates on all Italian American enclaves, but your book really it really dives deep into the New York City's Italian neighborhoods. So can you tell us a little bit, first of all, about yourself, about the Italian enclaves, historical society, and kind of then get into the meat and potatoes of why you decided to write this book? Because, of course, it's so important. And again, it'll kind of piggyback onto Stephanie and what she's written about. So kind of talk a little bit to that, what was your inspiration for the book? Talk a little bit about the Italian enclaves, historical society as well.
Sure, Tony, thank you. And so first and foremost, thanks for having me on. I think this is like my fifth time on the show. I have a blast with you. I just can't wait till we could do it in person again.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. I don't just pop on and I like to watch your show. Last night, as we were saying before, was a phenomenal show. All your shows are great. And thank you for having me on. And I'm really happy to be on with Stephanie. Because Stephanie and I work together quite a bit on the Italian Enclaves Historical Society. And she was actually an inspiration for helping me map out a way to go ahead and create the book because mm-hmm. of her book that we're done with Arcadia Publishing. So the way it happened, the genesis of it was just me going around the country taking photographs of all the Italian neighborhoods simply because I live in Brooklyn. And about 10 years ago or so, we started noticing a major demographic shift, in which case, coincidingly with that, a lot of Italian businesses were closed. Mm-hmm. And so as they started to close, I wanted to go out there and see if this was happening elsewhere in other Italian neighborhoods, but also to document the businesses and the processions, all these other things that are here. And so creating the website, or I should say the Facebook page, was the first order of business that I took to. And it started to really get a lot of momentum, a lot of fans and people were messaging me and the feedback was just phenomenal. So based on the feedback, it gave me the impetus to keep going with it. And mm-hmm. so I did. And in doing so, I just by osmosis met some amazing people, one of whom was John Napoli, who helped me with the book by donating a tremendous amount of time and his photographs as well. And John has a website called Il Regno. Mm-hmm. And I first started reading it years ago, and it's just an amazing blog essentially about Southern Italian Catholic traditions. And it's just an amazing, amazing source of information, of photographs. And it's just that it's one of the deepest things that anyone who's really into this culture, Southern Italian culture, even Italian culture and Catholicism could get into. So that was, you know, and we ended up meeting and becoming friends and doing a lot of things together. And that was kind of the foundation of Italian enclaves in many ways, because it was inspiring to me to see somebody out there on his spare time with a camera, not afraid to take pictures of things that were happening in an effort to document it and create an online platform. And so that was a huge inspiration. So then when I really moved forward with it, we wanted to raise more money, naturally, to go out further and more often to see different Italian enclaves throughout the country. And there are many, many, many enclaves. As Stephanie and as Tony and everybody else that follows Italian enclaves knows, there are many of them, so many of them, that we actually don't even know the total number. We're trying to continue to add to the list. The list just keeps growing. And so in any case, I hope this is the first of many books, but I was inspired to go out into the five boroughs of New York City, Staten Island, Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and the Bronx, and go into all of these different Italian neighborhoods. And so the first place to look was in history, looking at the churches. Mm. That was like the point of origin for all of the Italian neighborhoods. So by being able to go and establish where, or better yet, the list of all the Italian national parishes that were created for the Italian-American immigrants that came here, Italian immigrants that came here and became Americans, that wanted to become part of our society, but it was so hard. You know, not to go off too far on a tangent, but it was a shame that most instances they weren't allowed to worship in the same churches as the people who were here before them.
That's true.
So they were forced to create storefront chapels and create societies that utilize storefronts in many cases, where they could create these fraternal organizations and not only worship amongst each other in their own language, with their own customs associated with the religion, because everybody does celebrate Catholicism differently. The Italians are very well known for their processions. And so some of these things were seen as pagan by some of the other ethnic Catholics that were here prior to the Italians. So it was hard for them to go ahead and worship in the same places. So essentially, they created their own churches. It took it was a lot of bureaucracy. They cut through the red tape with the Diocese of New York and Brooklyn. And they were allowed to break ground and build their own churches. And they did it with their own hands. Like, for example, Our Lady of Mount Carmel, I read a great story about how the and that's in Harlem. There's a couple, one in the Bronx and one in Staten Island. But the one in Harlem, it was built by the people, the parishioners. And it was built at night, most of the time by moonlight, because during the day they had other jobs and occupations. Mm-hmm. So they didn't get paid for it. It was volunteer. So if you had like a group of men who were masons and they worked and coordinated with the carpenters and the bricklayers and so on and so on and everybody put their trades to task. You had the artisans and everything else to come in with the paintings and what have you. So that's little by little, by moonlight at night, while these people were moonlighting right from their regular jobs, they were building churches, and eventually that's where the communities were rooted. So in my research, I had to really distinguish where all the churches were in order to really figure out all the Italian communities that originated.
That's a great point.
And it worked out, Tony. It was amazing because it worked out in such a way where through my research, it was sad to find out a lot of the churches originally that were built were demolished in the mid-1900s. So you had like people came, they were here in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, and then they created these churches, they built them, and they had generations go forth with their sacraments, and everything happened here from baptism to death, all these different things. And by the time my parents were born, these churches were already demolished.
Yes. That's even like, what was the one, Our Lady of Loretto, was on Mulberry Street, right?
So
on the north end,
exactly. That was the Sicilian church there, and then there was another one in Brownsville, Brooklyn, which was just demolished a few years ago. And I was fortunate enough to be able to take some photos of the outside of that church, but the surrounding neighborhood is gone. So good point, and that's what I wanted to mention before I stopped talking, which is that the book, by the way, isn't a complete list of Italian neighborhoods in America, in New York City. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is we're optimistic based on the demand and based on, you know, the viewership that we have, that we'll be able to make a part two that'll encompass other neighborhoods that are in there. So that's not the total list, people. But by the way, just so you know, there are more neighborhoods in Queens, especially, and other neighborhoods in Brooklyn, like in East Flatbush, Pigtown and stuff like that, that weren't mentioned in this book that we hopefully have a chance to take photos of. But the reason they didn't make the first cut is simply because there may not be enough remnants in those neighborhoods to really constitute enough to put in for one particular book.
Yes. But you know something, Ray? I mean, like you said, there are so many of these enclaves that over time that they kind of melded with other cultures, with other ethnicities, and really they just became American and less Italian. So it was kind of just, you know, they were Americans, and then they were Italian blood, but they were American, and, you know, getting the hamburgers and the hot dogs. They weren't going to the pork stores. They weren't, you know, frequenting the bakeries and stuff like that. But it still needs to be documented. It still needs to be said that, okay, yeah, there were Italians that came to whatever the neighborhood is. I mean, just for example, I grew up in Lodi, New Jersey, and back when I was a kid, it was all Italian. I mean, like, everybody was Italian. But as the years go on, and as, you know, the generations get a little older, they move to different towns, and the ones that die off, then it becomes – then it's like a turnover in a way. So, I mean
– you're absolutely right. And Tony, let me say, you know, we came in contact just because our interests are so much aligned that, you know, it would have been inevitable that we bumped into each other eventually. It's great that we did. So when we did at that inflection when we were both, you know, creating our social media pages and everything, and it's funny because, like you say, there's so many different transitional aspects of how a neighborhood changes and goes from being an Italian neighborhood to, you know, an American neighborhood, if you would, and you know, it's also funny because you have like Jerry Craze, right? He's he's on our board. He's a very well established author himself, and he is actually pointed out that you have like these theme park Italian neighborhoods, right? Like kind of like a Disneyland Italian neighborhood, where it's like a faux Italian neighborhood. So it's not an Italian neighborhood anymore. It's not a Little Italy anymore, based on the composition of people that are there. But it still has the businesses, and it has, you know, the feasts and so forth, and the maybe a church that still remained, and people come back to it.
Yes.
And I also want to point out in regards to the book, the proceeds that I'm taking from the book that come to me are going directly from me to the Italian Enclaves Historical Society. And there's also another component, which is some of the funds are being given to the St. Rocco Society of Potenza. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we both have the good fortune of sharing a friend in Stephen Rock.
Oh, yes, we do.
So he's done a tremendous amount, and he's in the book. He's featured in the book. There's a few people, you know, featured in the book. They make cameos here and there. But the most important cameos in the book, and I'm just going to stop talking, are the saints. So I wanted to give a lot of love to the saints in the book. So absolutely. You'll see a recurring theme. You'll see St. Anthony. You'll see all of the saints that we love, St. Padre Pio. You'll see Mother Cabrini in there. And so that's my little way of also giving them some homage.
Yeah, actually, speaking of Stephen LaRocca, there he is.
There's Stephen, myself, Steve. And our sons walking in the procession of St. Anthony.
But so talking about these Italian enclaves, these little neighborhoods, this is a great segue to talk to Stephanie now, because she grew up, or she's from an area of Northeast Pennsylvania that's probably, I think we talked last time, it is the largest Italian population, or one of the largest Italian populations in the state, and then if not the country, correct?
Yes, that's completely true. So in the 2015 American Community Survey from the United States Census, there were 5 communities in northeastern Pennsylvania that were part of the top 20 Italian communities in the United States. So 2 of those communities were in Lackawanna County, which is where I'm from. The number one in Pennsylvania from that was actually my hometown of Dunmore, so very proud of that. And then the other 3 were in neighboring Luzerne County.
And there's a picture of your book about Dunmore. Yep.
Yes, that photo actually is one of my favorite photos ever for any of my books. So that is the Dunmore World War II Welcome Home Parade. And they are actually marching down Drinker Street, which Drinker and Blakely Street are the 2 main drags in Dunmore. So that is probably one of the most recognizable images of our town. But seeing something like that, and those photos, you know, they came from a woman's attic.
What? Really?
Yeah. So at the time I was getting my journalism career started, and I was working for a bank, Fidelity Bank, that is actually on the corner of Drinker and Blakely Streets in Dunmore. It's actually just slightly past where the photo is, behind where those soldiers are marching. And a woman came into the bank knowing that I was working on this project. And she said, "Listen, I found all of these photos in the attic. They're not labeled, but here, you could have them." And come to find out, they're the only surviving photos of the Dunmore World War II Welcome Home Parade. So it really means a lot. There's a lot of those photos in that book. I have something like that in all of my books. Like, there's that random story of like that one photo in Italians in Northeastern Pennsylvania. It's the 1892 Columbus Day Parade. Those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, even that cover photo there too, that's St. Rocco's in Dunmore. I mean, there's so many different stories behind the photos, and it's a wonderful thing to be able to tell those stories.
I think it's so important that sometimes, you know, some people, they just say, "Oh, it's a photo. I'm going to throw it out. I don't need a photo. It's a photo." But really, it's so important to preserve these photos. I mean, I'm constantly going through old photos, and I'm taking pictures of them just to have them on my phone. I think that you posted something I saw a while back, maybe a couple of weeks ago, about the My Heritage that you lets you colorize pictures. So I've been playing with that like crazy. So, you know, but really, it is so important to preserve these photos, because they tell a story. Everybody, look at this. Look at this beautiful picture. I mean, it tells a story about somebody's family. It tells a story about the history of somebody's life. And by saying, tomorrow's a trash, put it in the trash. It's literally saying that they're throwing out their past. But what I think that what all of you are doing to a certain extent is, well, not to a certain extent, you are preserving the past for our future.
It's 100% true. You know, Italians in Northeastern Pennsylvania was a very particular book with trying research different in Northeastern Pennsylvania in that at the time. So that book came out in 2004. So it was the year after I graduated from the University of Scranton. That book came out. That was actually part of my master's thesis in history with an Italian American concentration. I had to basically reconstruct our area's Italian American history because, you know, some of the communities had it. They had information about it, but it wasn't really put together in any kind of form. A lot of people were showing me maybe some newspaper clippings or some photos or just this random information that they had. And you had to go through a historic reconstruction process. You'll see in that book, there's a lot of photos that I got actually from museums. You know, people that maybe found them in their attic or found them just lying around. Those 1892 Columbus Day photos, they're probably, you know, besides the Dunmore ones I just talked about, my favorites. Because at the time, I knew that they existed because my internship for my history master's degree was actually at the Pennsylvania Anthracite Heritage Museum. And my job was to help catalog all the stuff that they had. And the one day I kind of got bored and was going through archives and was like, oh, let me look through old photos. I love looking through old photos anyway. And I was like, this is really cool stuff. And I saw the 1892 Columbus Day photos, and the Anthracite Heritage Museum, when it came time for me to do this book, helped me get in touch with the original owners of the photos. And they were more than gracious, the Riggi family of Dunmore. And they helped me get, you know, the copies of them. And they were fabulous about the whole thing because they wanted other people to see them. As far as we know, they are the only two photos in existence of the 1892 Columbus Day Parade in Scranton.
Wow.
And that is considered Scranton's largest parade ever. And I think I told you about this last time that we spoke. Scranton is known for its St. Patrick's Day Parade. We have the third largest St. Patrick's Day Parade in the country. And according to Scranton Times records from October of 1892, when this event took place, that was even larger than our largest St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Really?
Yes. It's pretty crazy. So Scranton police actually considered opening up fire hoses on the crowd because the crowd was a surging mass of people, they said, that they couldn't get through and it was turning into a fire hazard. The police actually had to go on horseback and cut through. And if you've ever been to downtown Scranton, some of this kind of shocks you when you look at our downtown because you're just like, how did all these people fit? But it was basically clogged up with people. There were so many people there. And the thing that I thought was the coolest, and I wish there was a photo. There's an actual drawing in one of the Scranton newspapers from 1892 of it, but I want to see photos if they exist. So if anybody's out there and they have these photos, please let me know. They actually took the buildings in downtown Scranton, and all of the buildings were decorated with Italian themes.
Wow.
And there were actual buildings. The Samter Building in downtown Scranton actually took the Columbus statue that we have on Courthouse Square and did a miniature version of it. The Columbus statue was actually dedicated during this festivity. So, you know, that was part of it. And they had this amazing exhibit. And supposedly the Samter's building had the most beautiful of all the exhibits. But unfortunately, there's no photographic evidence. I even know the developer that is redeveloping the building. And I've worked closely with his, the woman who's in charge of the building now. She oversees it. And they tried seeing if they could find it through archives. And unfortunately, there's nothing that exists of it, which is a shame. So yeah. Doing work like this, where you're able to preserve at least something for somebody so you can say, hey, this event happened and it was historically significant to our city. It's important.
Oh, it absolutely is. You know, and I think that that's that what you're doing by writing these books is that you are preserving this history, and that if people are out there, like you said, hey, get in touch with all you guys. I mean, if you, you know, if you have information about, you know, a little known Italian enclave in wherever, I mean, really, there's Italian enclaves in places. I mean, you wouldn't think of, like Omaha, Nebraska, and you know, I mean, just like, you know, places that blow your mind that there's Italians here. Yeah, there are Italians here. So, Michelle, talk a little bit more about Ovunque Siamo. So if somebody wants to write for your journal, what are the requirements?
So basically, because it's a literary magazine, it's just like any other literary magazine. You submit your work for consideration. So we accept poetry, art, creative nonfiction, fiction, you know, any genre of writing. And basically, you know, we have a submissions page, and people who submit should send it to the appropriate editor. We do book reviews. Actually, Stephanie was my wonderful book reviews editor until she got this wonderful new job, and she had to leave us, but she brought a lot of wonderful authors and books to Ovunquisiamo that we reviewed. So we review books. We have some in-house reviewers, and then sometimes people will pitch reviews. But, you know, you submit and we try to get back to you within 5 days. I have a wonderful poetry editor, Chad Frame, who's an absolutely stellar poet, wonderful editor. Jennifer Martelli is one of our reviewers. George DiStefano, you know, a wonderful, well-known journalist who also reviews for us. Theodora Petrona, my cousin Pat Singer, Pat Messina Singer, who is our in-house illustrator, illustrates a piece that I have accepted, and I'll hand it over to her and say, illustrate this in whichever way you want to interpret this. So we have some in-house people, but otherwise, you know, you just submit and we consider your work. And we can't accept everything, but yeah.
How can people then submit? Through your website?
Yes. So if you go to, www.ovunquesiamo.com.
Web.com. I put it on the bottom of the screen.
Right. We even have a podcast, which is owned by Mike Fiorito.
Okay. He wrote Call Me Guido?
My press actually, Ovunquisiamo Press, that was the first book that we published, was Mike Fiorito's Call Me Guido, which is a book of amazing Italian-American stories. He's been an amazing addition to what we've got going. He has, yes, that's his book. He's a wonderful human being. He does so much for the Italian-American community, just like Stephanie and Ray, curating the culture, always willing to pick up on some aspects or nuances of the culture that sometimes get forgotten. You know, I just want to say something about the work that Ray and Stephanie are doing with their books, which is, to me, so important, which is why Italian-American writing is so important, because, you know, generations ago, Italian-American history was unwritten by anyone. So if you had immigrants coming over from Italy who were, you know, what they would say, unlettered, who couldn't read or couldn't write, and were pretty much on the lower rung of society, no one really cared about their history. Gay Talese, the writer Gay Talese, who wrote Unto the Sons, is from Maida in Calabria, where my family is from. In fact, the whole first half of his book is about the immigrants who came from Italy and settled in my town and basically built the town from the ground up. But there were not many people who were documenting these untold lives, which is why I'm so interested in my family and the Italians in my town, because those that came before us paved the way, but it was largely unnoticed and undocumented, and no one talked about it. And, you know, we're here to change that, those of us that can.
Let me ask you, why do you think it was? Why do you think that they were afraid to, I guess, either write about it or to talk about it? What can you kind of give me what you think the reason was?
You know, I think they suffered a lot of hardships. I think there was not the luxury in life. I know with my own family And, you know, I grew up in an immigrant, you know, a very largely immigrant community, an immigrant parish. In my grade school, probably, you know, a huge percentage of especially in the 70s, were immigrants right from Italy. I think life was pretty hard scrabble. I think that you didn't have the luxury of writing about, you know, people weren't writing in their journals. And one of my relatives from Sicily said to me that when my great grandmother left to come to America, that they lost touch. Like her family, she remembers her mother-in-law saying, "We'll never hear from her again." If my great grandmother couldn't read or write, there was not even any way of keeping in touch. You know, it's just survival every day. There are exceptions to that, of course, but they just didn't, you know. Just a quick story is when I went to Italy on my honeymoon, my mother-in-law, I was reading a book one day, and it bothered my mother-in-law a lot. So every day I'd read a little bit of this book. And she said to me, finally, it bothered her. It seemed to have my nose in a book was a waste of time.
Huh.
It didn't make it. She said, it doesn't make anything. You know, I never forgot that. You know, I was very young. I never forgot that. So there's that mentality of the people who do the reading and writing, and then there's us. And we do the hard work, you know.
Yeah.
Also, I know in my father's family, my mother's family too, you didn't talk about your life. Like, I'll grill my father, and I've grilled my father's sister and his brothers about things in their life. And there are a lot of things that they don't know, and there are a lot of things that they know and they don't want to say, because there's that culture of silence. You know, when Mario Puzo got his big contract for The Godfather, and he told his mother, the first thing she said was, "Don't tell anyone."
Wow.
It's that there's a culture of silence. So
yeah, you know, I mean, that's very true, because I think that even like they wanted a lot of us to I guess to kind of maybe not be like you know, I guess too American or too you know, we still had to kind of be, you know. But I was actually the first in my family of my parents to graduate college. But you know, and again, like you said, there is a lot of mystery and secrets to our families, because even like I constantly do genealogical research. And just recently, back in late last year, I reconnected with my family in Sicily. The last time anybody had any contact with them was in 1973 or thereabouts. Mm-hmm. So it took an over 40 years I talked to my cousin. She says, for years, I've been looking for my family in America, and I couldn't find anybody.
Wow.
You know, and then, you know, once, so people can say what they want about Facebook and social media, but there is some good that can come from it. And I think that what you guys are, all you guys are doing, guys and gals are doing, is really, you know, really promoting our culture and our heritage through this means. Again, I wouldn't know any of you if it wasn't for Facebook. So I think that really is a testament to social media, and that it does bring, you know, if it's used for the right thing, it will bring people together. And I think, you know, Ray, I think that you have to just unmute your mic, Ray. I want to point this question to Ray. You know, Ray, do you think that people are into this whole social media and being able to follow the Italian enclaves on Facebook, Instagram, you know, Twitter, stuff like that? Do you think that people appreciate all this hard work that you're doing?
If it's an indication, like the inboxes are an indication, then yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. I've got to say, Tony, I didn't look, you know, it's bigger than me. It's bigger than just the people involved with what we're doing. It's the whole entire culture. And so, it's not hard to post photographs. It's hard to do consistently and give contact. That gets a little more challenging, but the inbox is constantly flooded with people who are thanking me and giving me suggestions and providing me with other content and tipping me off to places that I can go to and things like that. So it's definitely something, a resource at this point now, I'd say. where, you know, I've been contacted by multiple news agencies, you know, in different capacities, where it's just like, hey, put us in touch with this guy that we know you happen to know or you featured and that kind of thing. So it's just become a resource. And the biggest resource that I can provide is just other people. Mm-hmm. By being able to give access to the amazing intellectual property that is other Italian-American businesses, authors, people who are cultural preservationists that can, you know, conduct the sessions and stuff like that. So being a conduit has kind mm-hmm. of been like a facilitator, and that kind of thing has been really the blessing, you know, in disguise with the whole scenario. And like, I just want to say too, by the way, I'm really sorry for my appearance. I took a page out of your book, and I gave myself a quarantine haircut. And, you know, Tony, I got to say, so I'm just wearing the hat backwards. I'm all bummed out tonight.
That's all right. Don't worry about it. Hey.
No worries. I'm just saying it's funny because, like, a couple of generations down the line in the past, right, like our ancestors, if they thought that I was getting ready to be on a live television show or a live YouTube show dressed like this, I would get scalded. What's still going on? First of all, I wouldn't feel out to shame on this thing. But who would have known so many Italians are up in Pennsylvania, up in North Carolina? I really didn't know the extent of it. And so finding out all this stuff and reading, so like the books, right? Like, I know you collect Italian American books. Mm. I would assume that Michelle and Stefan, you guys have a similar interest, right? These are the things, the texts, the books that are not that don't make it somehow from the transition of being an actual text onto a digital format. Those are the ones we can't let slip through the cracks. And it's very important to accumulate those. And
no, you're absolutely right. But, you know, also, right, you know, again, it's also these little towns. I mean, like I always bring up the town of Raritan, New Jersey, that not many people know about as being a very Italian town. It's the hometown. Well, it's traditionally John Bassolone was born in Buffalo, New York, or upstate New York, but he was pretty much raised and reared in Raritan, New Jersey, and really Raritan was and it still is for the most part a very Italian town. They have a couple of Italian bakeries, they have a cafe, they have Espo's restaurant, they have the I'm gonna say it wrong. I say Di Lucia, but I think they call it Di Lucia's Pizza, which is like 4 or 5 generations old. So there really is this great Italian, even to be honest with you, I think most people want to be Italian, right? It's like that's the number one wanted to be heritage. But again, it's one thing to want to be something. It's another thing to actually be something and to actually give that something a good name. And
thanks for saying that. I'm sorry. I just want to say, you know, the thing is, right, like you have all the stereotypes and stuff like that. And it's like so important to draw a line and make sure, like, because you have Italian American and then you have Italian. And mm-hmm. and people who, I mean, coming from a neighborhood in Brooklyn where there are still a lot of people who came here from, whether it be Sicily, Calabria, Bari, whatever it is, and they're very proud of their heritage. But there's a big differentiator between being Italian from Italy, somewhere on the boot, whether Southern, Northern, all right, and being an Italian American. Mm-hmm. And then there are, like, you know, people who don't really kind of understand, like, you know, a pizza is the most eaten food in America. It's the most popular pizza. Every second, I think someone eats a slice of pizza, every two seconds, whatever. So it's like,
works okay.
You know, and I've got to get the name another author who I must reach out to for you to do another segment on Italian American authors. She wrote a great book, and it's the name is escaping me right now, unfortunately, because I have so many books that are like in the on plate spinning, all these different books. But she wrote a book about how like all these things in our culture and society are from Italy, and we don't know, like even dumbbells and certain things like that, like they just have, you know, their influence from Italy. But back to the whole enclaves thing, you know, like Raritan, you'd be so surprised, like what was an enclave at one point, and then it can get completely dissipated, and now it's just like, you know, when it's a melting pot like everything else in America. And, but, you know, like I think out of any other culture, I don't know if I'm wrong here, I'm conjecturing, is that like generational kind of like pride you know, my family came here 100 years ago, but like the pride's still there. Mm-hmm. And so is the interest and the knowledge and some of the tradition, you know, not all, but most of it I try to hold on to, right? And so we do it for our kids and what have you, if not just for our audience. So
yes,
I'd say that's more so than any other ethnic group that's moved, that's migrated to America. That's something to be said.
Actually, Paulie G says Uncle Vinny's. That's in Raritan. And then Mike DeSapio said, yes, Paulie G, post quarantine party at Uncle Vinny's. And speaking of pizza, Mike says, I ate two slices since you've been speaking, Ray.
Mike and I are going to have a friendly competition. We're not going to be compared. We're going to listen. Tony, you, me, Mike, whoever else, we got to go on a pizza tour.
You got to ask Paulie G. He knows all the pizza spots.
We're going to hit up Paulie G's, right? Like, that'll be the first spot. And then Carmine's got to hit Carmine's on Graham Avenue, okay? And there may be other spots, too. But we really need to do that and do it live. Is that possible? Can we stream it from the cell phone?
We can work something out. We'll figure it out. Actually, Paulie G also said, for a great chronicling of John Bassalone's war exploits, check out The Pacific on HBO. So there you go. There's a... Now, Stephanie, this book is another great book that you wrote.
Thank you.
It's all about Lackawanna County, and the reason, the particular reason I want to bring up this book right now at this very moment, and today is May 13th, excuse me, is because of what is on the cover of this book.
That is La Corsa dei Ceri, Saint Ubaldo.
It's a very bittersweet year, because unfortunately. The charity, this feast for Santo Baldo has been canceled both in Gubbio, where it originated, and here in America, in Jessup, Pennsylvania. So I know we were trying to work on doing a show about Santo Baldo, and hopefully, God willing, through Santo Baldo's intercession, we will get it done. But can you explain to us a little bit about Santo Baldo and this particular feast of so now, yeah, so explain. So is it called... explain it to me, please.
Sure. So it depends on who you're talking to. You'll hear people from northeastern Pennsylvania call it St. Ubaldo Day. You'll hear people call it by its real name, La Corsa dei Ceri, which is, you know, the running of the saints. Mm-hmm. You'll hear it in all sorts of different things around here, but the proper name is La Corsa dei Ceri, and it is held every May in Gubbio, Italy, as well as in Jessup, Pennsylvania. So Jessup is about 10 minutes away from Dunmore, where I live. So heavily Italian community with people who came from Gubbio. They came for you to settle in the work for the coal mines. And that photo that you just showed there was La Corsa dei Ceri itself. The photographer, Linda Anelli, I can't say enough of wonderful things about her. She donated the photos to the book, and she does an amazing job. You can see the three saints there and their different families. So the family of Santo Baldo is dressed in yellow. The family of St. George is dressed in blue. And the family of St. Anthony is dressed in black. And those three saints are the saints that protect Gubbio. The reason why St. Ubaldo is the protector saint, the patron of Gubbio, is because when he was actually Bishop of Gubbio, he was in negotiations with Frederick Barbarossa. And to make sure that he was okay to prove to the townspeople that he made it through these negotiations, nothing happened to him, he was actually placed on a wooden platform and carried through the streets of Gubbio. So that
the actual person, not a real statue.
Yes. The real person. So when he was alive and he was just Bishop Ubaldo and not Saint Ubaldo, he was taken through and carried through the streets of Gubbio. And that's how the tradition for La Corsa dei Ceri came to be. And it is only run in Jessup as well as in Gubbio. And Jessup always follows suit after Gubbio. So if Gubbio says we are not having it, Jessup will never do La Corsa dei Ceri before Gubbio. It would be considered a bruta figura, since we were talking about the figuras. They will always make sure that it's after, and Gubbio canceled theirs and Jessup followed suit. And very, very sad for the people of Jessup. That is, in my opinion, northeastern Pennsylvania's most traditional and most representative Italian celebration. It is not like something that you have ever seen before. If you've ever seen a traditional procession of a saint, this is not it. This is, these people train all year to run with these giant charity. They run up Church Street in Jessup. It's Jessup's main drag. And Church Street has a big hill. And that is a steep hill. And these men, they're a group of 10, and they're led by the capo dieci, so the head of 10. And they're going up that hill with this giant chero. And it's pretty intense. And I mean, if they knock that over or anything, I mean, that's a disgrazia. So they really put a lot into it. You know, there's a lot of passion that goes into it. It's their heart and their soul. And the town of Jessup, you know, they were so supportive of me when I wrote Italians of Lackawanna County. And it breaks my heart to see that this is not happening this year. They're doing their own thing. I don't want to announce what they are doing because it's not my place, but they are doing their own thing this year.
I think I saw something online.
Yes. They're doing some wonderful things. They're trying to make use of some current technologies for that. But, you know, their heart is broken because this is something so important to that town.
This is the website for, yeah, you can buy some store.
If you're interested, that store that you see there, you could purchase the different flags. You could purchase the masks. I actually purchased that flag that you're scrolling on right there. That one's going to be going up in my yard very soon. As soon as we have a decent enough day where they're not having rain in northeastern Pennsylvania, that's going outside. We Talk Shirty. It's a local company. They actually are handling this for the group. And, you know, they're doing whatever they can to have that spirit of the festival still happening. People are encouraged in Jessup as well as throughout northeastern Pennsylvania. So if you're from northeastern Pennsylvania, you're listening to this and you want to hang a flag or even just put the yellow, blue, or black outside, do that in support of this wonderful observance of Italian American culture, because to me, it really is the best one in our area. And, you know, as I said to you before in private, and I know that I've had the same conversation in many ways with Ray and Michelle, Italian Americans have to support each other. And if we don't, who will? Mm-hmm. I think that the reason why the four of us are the friends that we are is because we strongly believe in that. I would not be in the position I am in if it wasn't for Italian Americans supporting me. Dominic Candeloro and Jerry Crace are the two people that without them, Italians of Northeastern Pennsylvania never would have existed. Because Dominic is even the one who introduced me to Arcadia Publishing when I was fresh out of college. And Jerry just cheered me on from the get-go. And then the journey that Italians of Lackawanna County took me on 2 years ago, I never would have dreamed that I would be working in the Italian American field full time. Mm. That was just, you know, I can't believe it. I pinch myself every day. I'm so happy, you know, getting to do that. But it also brought met people like you, right? People like Michelle, who really profoundly influenced my life. And I think as Italian American writers and authors, and just as Italian Americans, we need to support each other, whether it's purchasing a book written by an Italian American author or watching a movie that an Italian American produced, or just simple things like flying a flag in honor of a festival that may not happen this year. Well, in my case, it's not happening. St. Ubaldo is not happening this year. Yes. Just doing what we can to support our community. If we do that, we're going to be around for years to come because people will see this as such a positive community. You know, they say there's two types of people. You're either Italian or you wish you were. And we want people to wish they were Italian. And This is one way of doing that. Because if you see how strongly our community supports itself, you know, you're going to want to be a part of that.
You know, I was thumbing through the book, and there's one image that is absolutely, it just really caught my eye, and it looks very, very Italian. Let me see if I can show it on screen here. It's the image of this particular Madonna.
Madonna della Buddha.
Yes. So it's from Calabria.
Yes.
I've been thumbing through this book a lot. Just look, because the pictures are beautiful, obviously, but just there's something about that particular Madonna that is really just like, wow, that's beautiful. Can you talk a little bit about that Madonna?
Of course. So she is the representative version of La Madonna from San Mango d'Aquino in Calabria. And there is a group of people from San Mango d'Aquino that have a society here. It stemmed out of the San Mango d'Aquino Society that was in Scranton's Bull's Head section. So for those of you who might have a little bit of familiarity with the city of Scranton, it's kind of in between North and West Scranton. kind of going out of North Scranton on your way into West Scranton. It's called Bull's Head. My grandfather actually had a barbershop in Bull's Head. It was the Bull's Head Barbershop. Huh. And right down the street, as you're heading into what's called the Providence section of Scranton, you'll see this really amazing Mutual Aid Society building that is now occupied by a theater. But when the people from San Mango d'Aquino came to Scranton, they established this Mutual Aid Society to help each other. And now this manifestation that you see that takes place, that's actually on Father's Day weekend. And it's held at Scranton's McDade Park. And that is what they do still to this day. La Madonna della Buddha, that representation, they do that, like I said, on Father's Day weekend. They have a mass at the park and they have a procession and people are able to pin their money. They're able to pray to her. So it's a very special representation. It's actually one of the smaller Italian representations in our area, but definitely one filled with a lot of tradition.
She definitely, like I said, she definitely has that real Italian look to her.
Yes. Yes, that statue came from Italy.
So. I mean, it looks exactly like it. So I know that this has been great so far. I really appreciate your time tonight, but I want to talk. We have to talk about food a little bit. I mean, it wouldn't be at the table with Tony without some kind of food talk. So let's talk a little bit. I want to talk, Michelle. I've never been to Ambler, Pennsylvania. So are there Italian restaurants there? Are there Italian delis, Italian bakeries? Kind of tell us a little bit about Ambler.
Yes, Italians are everywhere. They're like potatoes. They're everywhere. You can see them everywhere. Ambler has so there's not an Italian bakery. We're definitely missing that. There's a real Italian presence with a bunch of pizzerias. There are Italian restaurants. Yes.
But not many Neapolitans settled in Ambler, correct?
No, not at all. No.
I always reference my friend Patrick O'Boyle. He always said that usually where the Neapolitans ended up, they have a great dessert culture or a great pastry culture because right. The Neapolitans are really, you know, you think of the sfogliatella, you think of the babas. The cannolis, no, the cannolis, those are, we're giving them, that's a Sicilian thing. We ain't taking that away from the Sicilians. But really a lot of the, you know, more, if it's more cookies, if it's more, you know, baked things, those things kind of went to, you know, the areas of Calabria, Abruzzo, places like that. And even Sicily. I mean, like, I think of the quintessential Sicilian cookie is what? A cucidada.
Mm.
Right. The fig cookie. And I know every area calls these cookies by other names. But so what are some of your favorite Italian or Italian American dishes? Do you have something that you particularly like to eat? Something that you particularly like to make?
You know, I don't know. I make a lot of Italian food. My niece said to me not too long ago that's all you know how to do. She said, you can't say you're a great cook because you only cook Italian. You know, I don't know. I like a lot of peasant dishes, a lot of things that don't have meat in them. You know, we do things like string beans, potatoes, and garlic. Dandelions were always a favorite. I never made them, but my children's father, their family was big on that. In the neighborhood that I grew up in, the Italians were always, you know, going around with their pen knives, you know, in the cracks of the sidewalks.
Oh, yes.
It was a huge thing.
What do you call that? Do you call it Turkish lettuce?
No, I just called it dandelions. Actually,
yeah, we call that Turkish lettuce. I don't know why.
So I don't know. I mean, a lot of peasant dishes from my the fava bean, pasta fagioli, you know, things. One of my sons loves chicken parmigiana. I never liked it, and I said, no one eats that in Italy, polpetti, you know, things like that. I have to admit, this is probably going to sound like sacrilege. I'm not a huge foodie, but I make Italian food. My mother is an amazing Italian baker, as is my father. also. So I make pretty simple but kind of peasant dishes.
But those are the best dishes. You think about it. That cucina povera, that's what sustained right. How many generations? That's how many right. generations did that sustain? And now you go to a restaurant and they charge you $35 for a bowl of tripe. Right. I mean, you know, where that would be something that was the, you know, you would be eating, it's like leftovers. Now it's haute cuisine or high cuisine.
One more thing is that in Ambler, I think the best cooking is done in people's kitchens. I think that there's not a representative restaurant in Ambler, even though the main street in Ambler, which I live very, very close to within walking distance, has tons of 5-star restaurants. None of them are what I would call, a representative Italian restaurant, but I think that, the large Italian and Italian American population, all the good cooking's being done in kitchens
at home. And yeah. That's an interesting thing, because I think during this whole quarantine period, a lot of people found out that they have a kitchen in their houses. they said, wait a second, what is this thing? It works. It starts fire. We have fire in our house. But it's one thing that I've been seeing all over Facebook, Instagram. People are baking that have never baked before, especially bread. That's a big thing I know. But yeah, that's what I heard. You can't buy flour and you can't buy yeast.
It's unbelievable. Tony, if you look in the New York City's Italian Neighborhoods book, you'll see a lot of great leads in there, okay, for places to go and get a good bite to eat in the five boroughs. And that's not nearly, touching really the tip of the iceberg. There are so many places in the five boroughs that have been here for over 100 years. And then there's another subset that's been here for over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And then you go into the 25-year or better, you're dealing with hundreds of businesses. Whether they're just actual restaurants to go get food or they're bakeries. We happen to have, I'd say, probably more bakeries in the five boroughs, Italian bakeries, than anywhere else in the country. Mm-hmm. And I remember as a kid, I would get, I would have to go up as an altar boy to church. But after church, my responsibility was to stop off at the bakery and bring home bread. But there was a different bakery for bread. As opposed to where you get your cookies, and you wouldn't get your cookies at the same bakery that you get your cannoli from, or other pastry. You go to a different pasticceria for that. So it was like within a 3-block radius, you had the fishmonger, you had the pork stores, or more than one pork store. So you had multiple bakers. You could get different loaves of Italian bread. You go here for semolina bread, and you go there for lard bread, and mm-hmm. so on and so on. So it's like, it's really a testament to the fact that this area in the five boroughs, especially, Bay Ridge, Bensonhurst, Diker Heights, had, per capita, the most Italians anywhere in the country, by a long shot. And mm-hmm. so like, you still have remnants of all those businesses in little pockets and like, as opposed to having like, homogeneously Italian neighborhood anymore, because you don't have anything like that anywhere, really. I mean, virtually nowhere.
Yeah.
In America. You have like these little pockets. So, but like, it's great to go for a little walk now. So I take my son. And we go look at where do you want to go? Oh, let's go here. And he'll know the restaurant and the plate and the plate to get at that stuff. But if you mention a certain restaurant to him and say, oh, we're going to get this, he'll look at you funny. Like, you don't get that here. You don't get, whatever the plate is.
From the mouth of babes.
So that's the thing, right? And it's like, so I would bet, I can't even say, that we can probably take the best plates from all our favorite restaurants, right? And if we put them all together, we'll have the best Italian restaurant.
That's a good point. Well, you're absolutely right about not you. You should. I mean, you should never. But you, if you want bread, you want semolina bread, you go to the bread bakery. If you want a granola or a cannoli or a cannolo, you go to like the place like Villabatta that makes amazing cannoli. So really, it is important to kind of. But again, I think that harkens back to the old school, back like in Italy, because you would go to the fish shop to get your fish. You'd go to the meat shop to get your meat. And really, everything had its place. And now, with all these supermarket society that we live in, it becomes very hard to recreate what we had years ago. But Stephanie, I know there are places in Scranton, especially it's in your book. I know I saw it here. I want to go there. I hope he's open. Catalano's.
Yes. Such good stuff. We are lucky. We have so many amazing Italian grocery stores and things here. But I have to say, I have two words for you when you're talking about Italian food, and it's Old Forge.
I know, the pizza capital of the world.
Yes. I mean, come on. They have that trademarked that they're the pizza capital of the world, much to the chagrin of the city of Naples. you know, the Old Forge pizza is iconic here. And the really crazy thing is that Northeastern Pennsylvania itself is a pizza capital, I would say, in the United States, because no matter where you are, there's a different pizza. It's crazy. You know, in Dunmore, we have it one way. My mother and I were talking earlier today. We were thinking about going down. There's a pizzeria in Luzerne County that we've been going to since I was a kid, that she's been going to since she was a kid. Wow. Called the Victory Pig. And their pizza is fried at the bottom. And it's like a Detroit style, but like accelerated is the best way to describe it. And it's just fantastic. We do have a strong pizza. There we go. Yes.
That was there a couple of years ago.
I love it.
The pizza capital of the world.
You know, the crazy thing is that everybody in this area has a specific Old Forge pizza that they like. You know, I'm good friends with Angelo from Arcaro and Janelle, so I will, of course, say his. His got ranked number one by USA Today in a pizza survey a while back. So, and also because it's delicious, and I'm not just saying that because he's a friend of mine. His food is really outstanding. But all of the Old Forge pizzerias, they're fantastic. And that came from the coal mining days. You know, they created their own style of pizza because the miners needed something to carry off to the mines with them. And pizza was portable. Oh, you're in our Caro and Janelle's. I love it.
There it is.
Such amazing pizza. You're making me so hungry for some. But, you know, we even have, like I told you the last time, you have to come to the Ruzzi Bar in Dunmore.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. I get cravings for that pizza. And now I discover they're new, that they have. It's not new. It's new to me because I'm just discovering all this. It's an old-fashioned pizza that's kind of like the tomato pies from Utica that they do. And I'm just like, great. Now I can't go there without ordering a tray of each. Like, what is this? And of course, in Northeast PA, we call it a tray of pizza. You know, that's like a typical thing from our area as well. So, you know, if you come here, just be prepared. It's going to be a pizza fest.
Hey, that's all right.
It's fabulous. And then you can come to my house and my mother could feed you pasta and polenta and all that other good stuff.
But you know, but one thing that I've noticed through your social media accounts lately is that you have trying to be, we are in the middle of this pandemic.
Yes.
We're in the middle of, you know, stores are shutting down constantly. Restaurants are closing down. But I see that that a lot of you guys are still supporting your local places by obviously you can't eat in the restaurant right now. But doing the takeout, doing the curbside pickup, doing delivery. So for that, I commend all of you for still trying to support the local economy, because really, you know, after this is all over, it's unfortunate. There's going to be a lot of places that we like that are no longer going to be here with us. So
we took a lot of losses already here in Brooklyn.
And that's
really
absolutely within the last few weeks, and just specifically within the last couple of weeks or last week. Just here with, you know, in my neighborhood in Bay Ridge, we lost some really good, long-standing businesses. Unfortunately, La Sorrentina on 11th Avenue, that was between 65th and 66th, although he moved his business to Queens to the Rockaways area, but, it was a big loss for our area. He actually had, some of the best food around. It was a pizzeria, started off as a pizzeria. He had like a patented chicken roll that had holes in the top with sesame seeds. It was out of this world. And it was like a foot long. This thing was a monster. It was delicious. They fried the cutlets just right. So before they put it inside the chicken roll, because there's a debate about that too, right? Like how to make the right chicken roll. There's another place here that doesn't bread the chicken at all and just puts in chunks of chicken breast, and it comes out great, but it's a different style of doing it. But anyhow, he closed, La Sorrentina closed, and we lost a lot of business and a lot of business owners, unfortunately. So yeah, you're right. We support Italian American businesses all the way. Yeah. We actually created a hashtag about a year ago because, you know, we saw this coming for years now. And so we created the Support Italian American Businesses hashtag in an effort to link up Italians with Italian American businesses all throughout the country. And it doesn't have to just be a food business. It could be any kind of business. It could be a plumbing business. It could be a construction business. It could be an attorney, an accountant, whatever. And so I think that's super important that we keep people, our people together, like Stephanie kept saying before, and supporting one another, because there's no real formal network for it, right? Mm-hmm. There's no real formal network.
That's true.
And you know what? We're really kind of in so many ways, you know, not in a political sense at all, but more, you know, kind of culturally marginalized in so many different ways, because we have very few options in terms of being able to get grants to preserve our culture. There are, but there's you know, it's kind of a shallow well at this point anyhow. So we really need to do it ourselves.
I can even most recent job for our family. I was in the world of the chambers of commerce. I worked for the Greater Scranton Chamber of Commerce, and I see firsthand right now how important it is for the businesses to unite. I make it a point every week to try to frequent at least one business that I know the people. This past week, in fact, earlier this week, my mother and I ordered takeout from our favorite Italian-American restaurant locally. It's called A Little Pizza Heaven. And I remember that you liked that on my Instagram. The family that owns that, they're a very proud Italian-American family, and they do a wonderful job. But people don't realize that these businesses are open for takeout. And it's really a shame, because, you know, I would hate to see a business like that close. These people are very kind, very passionate. They sponsor things that are going on in our community. And every dollar that you spend at a local business stays in your community. And that's important. You know, we try to keep it in the Italian American community as best as we can, but also in the greater community as well. And I think that with all of this happening, I noticed that a lot of people are trying to band together. I try to make it a point, you know, if I know the business owner and I want to get takeout or I want to get something, I try to go to that small business. You know, my life would be miserable without a Little Pizza Heaven, because I think they make the best cannoli in the area. You know, I mean, I want to see that business succeed. They're kind, good people, and they deserve that. And I'm sure that Michelle and Ray and you too, Tony, I mean, all of you could speak for your respective areas, that there's that one business that you would be like, the patchwork of my area wouldn't be the same without this business. Right. So I think that we need to stop and really reflect and think about that business and try to support them as much as we can. Right. So whenever I do purchase food, I try to Instagram them and tag them.
Yeah, definitely.
You know,
you're so right about that. And you have to tag them. And the funny thing is too, if you look on Instagram and you see all of the businesses that are donating food, whether it be to the police department, to the hospitals, and come on, 90% of the time, It's pizza or Italian food. We just did a phenomenal fundraiser. You know, I work on the board with the Italian American Baseball Foundation, and with Mike DiSapio and a lot of great guys like Joe Quagliano and Carmine Gang, going with Carmine's on Graham Avenue, Carmine and Sons. And these guys are working tirelessly to be able to forward food, not just taking the business, but have a reason for people to call up and buy plates that they're donating and driving out to the NYPD or hospitals. That's another way you can support your local Italian business. See if they're on board with something like that. As long as the logistics could get figured out, that's a great way to send them business to ensure the fact that they stay open.
Absolutely. Actually, I do have a comment here from I have a comment here from a Jeff DeMelio. He says, from Doylestown, been on Butler and Lime Kiln Pikes. I don't know exactly what that means, but is Doylestown a large Italian area?
No.
No? I know that I know it's a large Polish area, because they have one of the most beautiful shrines dedicated to Our Lady of Częstochowa. Right. If you ever get a chance to get out there to see, it's actually a replica. I know we're talking about Polish here, but it's a replica in the basement of the shrine in this church. It's a replica of what's in Jasna Góra in Poland. It's spectacular. If you can ever get out there to see it, it's one of the most beautiful churches I've ever seen around. But again, it's not Italian, but it's still part of the faith aspect of At the Table with Tony. But ladies and gentlemen, again, I want to thank you so very much for coming on the show. Before we conclude this evening, I want each of you to just tell us a little bit more about how we can find you, about your books, about your websites, you know, about, I think the last question I want to say is, how can we, or what can we do to nurture future generations of Italian American, particularly writers? That's the question. So Michelle, I'm going to start with you, please.
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, Michelle Messina Reale, R-E-A-L-E. I connect with a lot of people there. I also have an author page there. You can just look up Ovunque Siamo on Google and the publication will come right up immediately. You know, contact me there. We have a submissions page. You know, friend me on Facebook, communicate with me there. And I would say that writing begets writing, Italian-American writing begets Italian-American writing. Support people who are doing it, mentor them, nurture them, buy authors. Stephanie and Ray were right. You have to show your support that way. You've got to purchase the books. You've got to show up at readings. You have to mentor people into it. You have to share your culture with your nieces, your nephews, you know, the young people coming up now. Join societies, support your parish if that's your thing. Be a part of a culture that is living and breathing and that has a long, wonderful, illustrious history. And don't forget where you came from. Know where you came from and let that be your guide to where you're going.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Michelle. Ray? You got to unmute yourself, Ray.
Oh, sorry, Tom. Okay. Sorry about that. You go on and off. I apologize. So you guys can find Italian Enclaves on Facebook at Italian Enclaves, E-N-C-L-A-V-E-S, or on Instagram at the same. And we have a website that's being developed and under construction right now and hopefully gain some momentum, which it is. And that's ItalianEnclaves.org. And as you were speaking before, Stephanie, I pulled up Catalanos. Now I'm getting hungry again. Pulling them hoagies. So, like, we had this thing the other day. Like, are they hoagies? Are they grinders? Are they heroes? So anyway, so yeah. So the book is New York City's Italian Neighborhoods, and it's available at Walmart, Amazon, Target, many other stores. And unfortunately now with the pandemic, I think the safest way to order it would be directly from Arcadia Publishing or on Amazon or Target. And I'd like the takeaway for tonight to be, yes, support each other, support Italian authors, support Italian businesses. But to get out and write and create a book is a little different than wanting to. So sometimes where you find the want to, you have to also find the how to. And so in order to do that, I think it really the biggest takeaway is to follow through with your dreams, write down goals and actually hit those goals and create a network of people around you that you could tap as resources that could help you and give you information and keep you encouraged. And just like Stephanie mentioned before, she had Jerry Craze, and I was fortunate to have Stephanie and John Napoli. And so giving yourself mentors or people that you could bounce ideas off of that are going to keep you motivated and encourage you and not discourage you, that's the most important thing. And the second aspect of that, the second piece on that, is to make sure you actually execute. It's very easy to want to do something, and so many great ideas are just they're fleeting moments. And without execution, unfortunately, great ideas don't come into fruition. But with a little bit of elbow grease and like hard work, like our ancestors proved before us by building churches at night, by having a little motivation and working those extra few hours a week is going to make the difference.
Absolutely. You're totally right there, Ray. Absolutely. And Stephanie.
Okay, well, people can find me for my writing aspect of my career at stephanielongo.net. I also have a Facebook page, Stephanie Longo Writer, or you could just friend request me. I love to talk to people, as you can probably tell. And of course, I cannot publicize anything that I do without also saying, go look at Ray's Italian Enclaves, go look at Michelle's Ovunque Siamo, and please go check out the Italian American podcast. I am very blessed to work with such a wonderful group of people, and I love every day that I get to do that. As for advice, I kind of dovetail off of the podcast a little bit, and I'll get to the podcast in a second. I think the number one thing is that you cannot, under any circumstances, let anyone deter you from writing. When Italians of Lackawanna County won the gold medal that it won, I had a book signing a few weeks later, and it was a shock to my system because my eighth grade English teacher walked in. This is the same English teacher that told me I would never be a writer.
Wow.
And she saw me with my books and she's like, "What are these?" And I said, "They are mine." She goes, "You?" And I said, "Yep." And she just kind of glared at me and walked away. And, you know, the eighth grade me, when she told me that, when I wanted to be a writer, was absolutely devastated. Her voice played in my ears for years. And it took a long time to get past that as a person, as a writer, because you're a child in eighth grade. You're forming and you're looking at your teachers to be mentors. And unfortunately, that's not what happened. I was lucky that I had my mother who always encouraged me. But, you know, when you're getting it at home from one person, but then in school with the people who are teaching you to do what you want to do, and they're telling you that you're lousy at it, it's, you know, not a good thing. But now I'm in a position and I have to give credit to John Viola and to Pat O'Boyle. I have to. They will probably kill me for doing this, but I'm in Pennsylvania. They're not. So I think I'm safe. They have been just incredible to me since joining the podcast family. And that's the kind of positive energy and friendship and mentorship that you need. I wish everybody had one of them in their lives, just like I wish everybody had one of the three of you in their lives, because this positive energy that you feel when you're around people that have the same passion and people who believe in you, that is so important. And if you can just be kind to somebody, nobody is ever going to be perfect when they are starting off. But if you're kind to that person, and nurture them, you could do this, you might just be encouraging the next Pulitzer Prize winner. And right. Wouldn't that be a wonderful thing for them to look back at you and say, "Hey, thanks to this person, I was able to make my dream come true." I would rather be the hero in someone's story than the enemy in someone's story. And I would hope that for anybody. So I guess my advice to anybody that wants to embark on a writing career is look for the people who are those guideposts, who are those lighthouses in your life, who actually believe in you and make you feel that you are just as important a part of the conversation, even if you're just starting out, even if you don't know, trust yourself and believe in yourself. Don't listen to the people who had something bad to say about you, because those words always stay with you, but eventually you're going to find more voices that silence that voice. And once that voice is silenced, you're going to do amazing things.
You're absolutely right.
Yes, the American community, there's no question, without any doubt whatsoever, without any shadow of doubt, that there are a lot of naysayers and a lot of pessimistic people in any community. So the fact of the matter is, if you're a young Italian American, or, you know, you want to do something and you want to be provocative and you want to, you know, you have an idea and you're inspired, don't let anybody naysay you out of it. And Stephanie, that was great. You're absolutely right about John and Pat.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I love working with them. The whole podcast team. I can't say enough of good things.
Tony, too. I got to say, Tony, we got to get you on the Food Network. I keep saying him and Paulie G. Talking pizza on the Food Network.
That would be a hell of a show. I gotta tell you, that would be me and Paulie G. That would be a heck of a show. I do want to mention there is a great resource or a great bookstore. It's actually in the north end of Boston called I Am Books. You can find them online at iambooksboston.com. It's a small little shop, but they are online and you can find some of their stuff. You know. The books, you know, Stephanie, can you find your books there?
Yes. Actually, Nicola, the owner, is a good friend of mine. I've spoken at his Idea Boston conference twice. I've spoken at his store. He is just, you will meet him, and the second that you meet him, you will absolutely love him. He's just fantastic. He is so passionate about Italian American heritage and culture that you walk into the store and it's like walking into family. So you could find my books are there, even though they have nothing to do with Boston, they still sell them. And I'm so thankful for that. You know,
actually, they're great. I picked up this book there over the summer when I was there for the St. Anthony's Feast.
Yeah.
Religious festival processions.
He cares so much about his community.
And I do want to mention that at 10 o'clock Eastern time, the San Diego Italian Film Festival is going to be showing a documentary called Italians by the Bay, all about the Italians of the San Francisco Bay Area. It's free. It's going to be online. You can just Google. Actually, it's if you go to San Diego Italian Film Festival.com and then search for this movie. I think it's on the main page. They're going to be showing this movie free for anybody to watch it. 10 o'clock our time, Eastern time, 7 o'clock Pacific time. So I'm definitely looking forward to checking that out. I've been to San Francisco once, and again, a great Italian-American community out there.
Tony, speaking of San Francisco, there's in North Beach a bookstore called Libreria Pino. And it's an Italian bookstore of all really well-published or well-distributed American books in Italian.
Wow, that's interesting.
He's a one-of-a-kind shop. He has like every major paperback, hardback, anything that's really major that's hit the press or been published. He has it there in Italian. Wow! So I highly recommend it. When I was in North Beach, I was blown away.
That's great. Well, again, I want to thank Michelle. I want to thank Stephanie. I want to thank Raymond for taking the time out to come on At the Table with Tony show tonight. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. This has been a blast. We'll definitely have to do this again, bring on some more authors, talk more about food, about our culture, about our heritage. And, thank you for all that you do. That's what I want to say. I want to say thank you for all that you do. Thank you for being passionate, for being proud of your Italian-American and your Italian heritage, and for bringing that forth to the world, because we need more light in the world. Like Steffi said, we need those lighthouses. We need light in the world, because this can be a dark world sometimes. But if these little beacons of hope are out there, we can find the light. I think what did St. Francis say? If you have to light, be the light in the darkness, right? I think it's one of St. Francis. I don't know if it's falsely or it's I think they attribute it to him. I don't know if he actually said it. But you have to be the light in the world, and really that is so important. But again, I want to thank you all for tuning in to the At the Table with Tony live stream show. Next week we'll be doing a show with the guys and gals from D'Abruzzo, New York City. They make the spadini, the Abruzzese spadini that you grill. So we're doing a show next week, and then tentatively scheduled for the 26th of May. Tony Gimignani, speaking of San Francisco, he is he's a world pizza champion. He will be on the show tentatively we're seeing May 26th. So that's kind of some of the things that are coming up. And of course, there's always things going on at the table with Tony on Facebook, Instagram, all that kind of good stuff. So we'll see you next time. Ciao for now.
At the Table with Tony would like to thank its sponsors, Rocco Muriale, Rob Quick, Joseph Cirillo, Raymond Guarini, Tom Gilmore, Oli G, Peter Ziza, Brian McGuire, Peter Ferreira, Rich Ottenstrauer, Anna Mavrianos, Antonio Pepinella, Anthony Ferraro, Sandra and Bob Lamotta, Mike Guero, The Italian Enclaves Historical Society,